because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless
you. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's look at this week in the Capitol and in politics. Well, J.R., it happened again. The presumptive, there's that P word, presumptive nominee Donald Trump said something that, well, Wisconsin Republicans, because of their national standing, had to respond to. I'm referring, of course, to Mr. Trump saying that the federal judge should recuse himself because of his Mexican heritage. His parents were Mexican, even though he was born in the great state of?
Indiana,
state that you know and love. So let's look at the reaction. U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan, a textbook definition of a racist comment. Senator Ron Johnson, through a spokesman, said the senator disagrees with Trump, just as he has in the past, and Johnson's comments are important because he's in such a tight race with Russ Feingold. I want to focus, though, a little bit on what Governor Walker said first. One day he said, it's just sad in America that we have such poor choices right now. Then the next day, when reporters asked him, this is what he said about Mr. Trump's comments.
Well, right now I'm focused on calling out, as I have the last couple of days, the fact that I believe what he said about the judge is wrong, not as a Republican, not as a political person, but I think it's just wrong as an American. It's just very clear that as an American, there should not be a judgment based on any of those categories. Again, be it religious, ethnicity, race, sex. And right now I'm just trying to focus on joining with many others like me who believe that he needs to be called out on this and that he needs to make it abundantly clear to the American people that he does not embrace those ideas. And I think it's particularly important between now and the convention he does that.
J.R., he twice said that as an American, this is not right. He twice used the term American. Is the governor laying the groundwork to unendorse Donald Trump, assumes that he endorsed him?
He's at least creating space. Well, what Walker said all the time is, I signed a pledge. I was running for president to support the nominee. I'm sticking to that pledge. He is creating space. Some people nationally are taking it as a sign that he is moving away from the endorsement of Trump. Well, the question kind of is why and what does it do from long term? Because you could argue that Governor Walker, by if he gets away from Trump, could be creating space enough that he could say in 2020, look, you know, I got off the Trump train early. I realized this guy was a train wreck and called him out. I was more forceful than others. I'm a little bit more clean, if you will, less dirty from the Trump experience of 20. Now, this is assuming that Trump continues on this path and damages the party in 2016. So that's a big assumption right now. We're still months out. Trump could turn things around.
Absolutely.
Be more disciplined.
5 months out, anything can happen.
But there could be a calculation there of, one, I'm sure Governor Walker, like almost every Republican I've talked to, is unhappy with the Trump comments. But two, there's also like, well, there's a way to create some space here and give me a little breathing room with this guy. Johnson and Ryan are a little bit different because they have an immediate concern. Now, Johnson is interesting. He's trying to go on offense with this. Not only is he answering the question about Trump saying he should retract the comments, but also saying, well, when's Russ Feingold going to withdraw support of Hillary Clinton, who could be indicted now? There's a big could be indicted. I talked to people about this week. They thought that might be a little bit tough to kind of create that entire pivot because Hillary Clinton's issues with the FBI and the server stuff will be played out, you know, over the next couple of months and be done. Trump is going to be there until November, we assume, barring some kind of craziness in Cleveland. For Paul Ryan, there's another different dynamic, and that is that he basically had to endorse Trump last week because he is the Speaker of the House. He is the de facto leader of the Republican Party. He is also chair of the convention. The longer he dragged out endorsing Trump, the more of an issue it became. Yes, he was creating kind of cover, if you will, for his members who were in tight races, who didn't want to endorse Trump. They still now have the Ryan model of, well, like what Paul Ryan said before, I still want to see more from Trump before I endorse him. They have that cover now, but eventually he had to get there, and so he got there. Now, the problem for Ryan is that within hours of getting there, Donald Trump makes the comments about the judge and his Mexican heritage, even though he was born in Indiana, and now you see Paul Ryan, who's said basically, I'm endorsing Trump or supporting him because of the House GOP ideas. Yep. It's more likely they'll become law with him than Hillary. He's rolling out these ideas this week, and one of the questions he's getting asked about, Trump. It's not about the poverty package. The first question was Trump's comments, and you know, I don't know Paul Ryan personally. I've interviewed him a number of times. I've covered him for 16 years. But you could just tell his body language during the news conference where he was just like, I can't believe I've got to answer questions about Donald Trump and this this distraction from our message right now.
He wants to play offense. He came out one day with the House Republican plan on the economy and jobs, but all he got was Trump, and those were the headlines.
Yes.
Today he came out on a strong military defense, but his party is still debating the Trump thing. And one stat, when you go to the Census Bureau, Hispanics make up almost 7% of Wisconsin residents. It's the second biggest minority. Mm-hmm. So this is not a small issue.
And for Paul Ryan, look at the cover of the New York Daily News on Wednesday. It shows a picture of Donald Trump and Paul Ryan there, and it says, "I'm with racist." You know, there is just, and for Ryan, you know, there was this kind of conservative intelligence, you know, intellectual elite, if you will. You know, these people who are really high-minded about things, they have a real purity in their cause, who saw Ryan's position as one that reaffirmed their never Trump stance. Now he's kind of lost those folks going, "Okay, Speaker, we get what you did, but at what line does he cross where you go, that's too much and I'm backing away? Is there a line? Can you decouple yourself?" There are people I've talked to, who Republicans, who predict that by November, if Trump doesn't change, that Republicans up and down the ticket will have to, like, basically push off from him and try and save themselves. Now, this is assuming, again, that he continues his path. We've seen no evidence, though, with Donald Trump, of changing the trajectory where he's going to be more presidential. There was that kind of teleprompter speech.
He used the teleprompter speech, although, you know, a few months ago he derided candidates
who
used teleprompters.
So can he get it together and be more presidential? A lot of people I talk to aren't sure. If he can't, this could be a perpetual problem for Republicans.
That's fascinating. Okay, we have 5 months till the election.
Yes.
Still. Okay, a new issue. In 2010, the governors laid down this marker: watch the number of private sector jobs I create. Mm-hmm. Created. Well, now the U.S. Bureau of Labor Stats came out yesterday and said in 2015, Wisconsin, you ranked 36th in the nation in job creation. You created private sector jobs. You created 31,670 private sector jobs. That's an increase of 1.3%. It's less than the U.S. average gain of 2.1%. But the one bit of good news, the state 2015 wage increased 5.7%, sixth highest in the U.S. But now score it. The governor said in 2010, "I'll create 250,000 private sector jobs over five years.
First term, 200,000 jobs.
Yep. Yes, and now let's look at the number over 5 years, 169,000. So the governor can't resent when reporters keep saying, "You laid down this benchmark. This is how you want us to score." What are your thoughts?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, you know, Republicans keep pointing to the 91,000 plus jobs. They almost have it like on their cell phones every day to pull up and tell you how many jobs are available on the Wisconsin website showing what's open. The skills gap is a problem. They're trying to address that. But the fact remains that we are short of the goal. And, you know, Governor Walker created that benchmark. Now, what he also has done, though, is a very masterful job of kind of muddying the water on that by saying, "We've brought back the jobs we lost during Governor Doyle," which, by the way, almost every state has, because we went through a national recession,
right,
Doyle's last year, that wiped out all these jobs. We came back. There are more people working than ever before, which is true. There are also more people living in Wisconsin than ever before. All these kind of
million
caveats. But he's done a very good job with the message on jobs of, we're creating jobs, we have one of the highest labor participation rates in the country, unemployment is low. And it is a frustrating fact for Republicans of this odd dynamic of the growth rate, which, by the way, predates Walker being, we've lagged in the country for a long time.
Yeah,
the growth rate is not that great, but unemployment is really low. How does that happen? Democrats, meanwhile, have a boom of fodder to say, look, it's not working. These guys promised us all these tax cuts in 11 and 12 and 13 and 14. We're going to do all these things. And what are they produced? We're still 36th.
Okay. Well, let's listen to how Governor Walker mentioned many of those themes that you just outlined when he was asked about our new national ranking for 2015, 36th.
We've more than made up for the jobs that were lost under Governor Doyle's last term. In terms of percentages, we were slow in the recession. We are consistently coming out of the recession, and we've got more people working in our state than ever before. So it's a matter of making up for jobs that were lost. We never made promises about what our rank would be. We talked about how we were going to help create more jobs and more opportunity. It's indisputable that we have more people working in this state than we ever have before.
Assembly Democratic Leader Barca immediately called for a special session on jobs. That's not going to happen. And the governor was asked about that, and he just blew that up, saying, we want to give this issue back to some of the same Democrats under the Doyle administration.
He's saying they have no credibility. And again, he keeps going back to Jim Doyle and Democrats when they were in charge. Of course, it ended January, whatever,
2011. Is when Governor Doyle left office.
So Democrats keep asking, well, when's it no longer Jim Doyle's fault? Republicans fire back, well, when's Obama going to quit blaming George Bush for all the problems of the economy the first 5-6 years he's in office. So there is this kind of both sides are guilty of the, well, it's the other guy's fault, we're doing a better job. And the state is doing better, but it's part of a national trend where everybody's doing better, almost everybody's doing better because the economy has picked up.
Real quick on this issue before we go to the next subject, what do you expect President Obama and Hillary Clinton? What's going to be the number one theme in Green Bay on Wednesday? What do you think?
I would bet they talk about the whatever months of uninterrupted job growth under Obama, that's, I think, some kind of record. I can't remember exactly what it was.
66 months, I think.
Somewhere around there. They'll talk about that, how better off we are compared to before, the economy's doing better. I mean, what's interesting to me is they're going to Green Bay. And here's the political angle of that, all right? Any more in campaigns in Wisconsin, if you're a Democrat, it's not just about Green Bay turnout or Dane Valley turnout. It's the margin in the Fox Valley. You don't have to win the Green Bay media market. You have to hold down the Republican margin up there. And if you look at the numbers for Hillary Clinton up in Green Bay, they are not good. They're also not good for Donald Trump. So if Hillary Clinton comes into Wisconsin come November and she can turn out Green Bay or turn out Milwaukee, turn out Madison, and just hold Green Bay to like a 51-50% Trump win, yep, she's in really good shape to win Wisconsin statewide because those are the three population centers. And Republicans are so good at the wow counties. Dems are so good at Milwaukee and Dane County. It's all about the margin of Fox. So that's, if they're going to see people coming, you'll see base visits in Milwaukee, Green Bay, the wow counties for Trump. You'll see the occasional swing in Western Wisconsin, and Green Bay is getting a lot of attention.
But it's very, very interesting to me that the President Hillary Roadshow now, it's going to stop in Pennsylvania, one other Midwest state, and then Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Because that's supposed to be Trump's strength, right? I mean, Wisconsin has gone Democratic in every presidential race since Reagan in 1984. Pennsylvania, since 88, I think, has gone for Democrats. But there's this, you know, the Rust Belt, Upper Midwest, where you want to call it, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, where Republicans are saying, well, look, Donald Trump does well with white voters, especially those without a college education. There's a lot of those in Wisconsin and these other states. There's an opportunity there. They're trying to undercut that possible inroad he could make with those voters.
Okay, new subject. Right, the Government Accountability Board, which goes out of business here in a few days, mm-hmm, is hearing 13 challenges to the 365 candidates to file nomination papers. I think you and I just opened a press release from one of the challengers to Representative Leon Young, saying the incumbent in office since 1993 could be bounced for not filing enough nomination signatures on his nomination papers. So what are some other challenges that GAB will have to decide?
There are challenges both to Leon Young and Christine Sinicki, both on the same grounds, essentially, that they didn't file enough ballot signatures. There are challenges to 7th Congressional District, Republican challenging Republican Sean Duffy, Libertarian up there. I mean, it runs the gamut. And they're all basically about the same thing. You screwed up somewhere in nomination papers. Mary Chaya, a lawmaker from Irma. She's got, Democrats have challenged hers. You know, a lot of these, if you've looked at nomination papers in the past, you get this kind of summary from the GAB and the elections board of so-and-so candidate filed and the number of signatures.
Yeah.
It's 200 for assembly seat, 400 for a Senate seat. If you are at 208, 215, 220, you are inviting somebody to look through your papers and go, oh, I see this problem, I see this problem. And if they get you to 199, you're off the ballot unless you can fix them. So that's part of the, they've done this themselves, if you will. Some of these candidates have will, right, at least, by coming in so low, it creates the opportunity to say, well, there's a problem here, and knock them off.
There was an unusual wrinkle, though, in Representative Mandela Barnes didn't file saying, I'm not going to run, since he's running for the Senate, challenging Senator Lena Taylor. Now, we can debate whether that was intentional or unintentional, but what it did is it allowed former Democratic Representative Jason Fields to file, along with Darrell Gibson and Brandon Jackson. Now, you and I were talking. Mr. Fields made some pretty amazing disclosures yesterday, mm-hmm, that he struggled with alcoholism, that he struggled with depression, and now he's in this war with Senator Chris Larson. What's the backstory on that?
This goes back to 2012. I mean, in 2012, Jason Fields lost his assembly primary to Mandela Barnes in a race that was seen as kind of pro-school choice versus the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
And Jason Fields is an ardent backer of school choice, and he's gotten some pretty substantive campaign donations from the voucher choice lobby.
You look at his white papers released this week as part of that statement. He talked about needing to bulk up private education to allow them kids to escape these failing public schools.
Yep.
That is not going to win you any fans, the progressive base of the Democratic Party turnout in these primaries. Now, that said, this is kind of a reprisal of 2012 in which it was viewed, correctly or not, that Chris Larson was behind Mandela and that his kind of progressive operation helped turn out voters that beat Fields. Fast forward to 2014, Darrell Gibson was Larson's deputy campaign manager
okay.
on his bid for county executive. There's a tie there. Mandela yep. is running for the Senate.
Yep.
So Fields is, when I talked to him yesterday, he said, I asked him, well, the gloves sound kind of like they're kind of off on this race. He said, yeah, they took him off first. You know, I'm just kind of punching back here. And he is airing out a litany of kind of grievances, if you will, with these gentlemen that they're not doing enough for the district, and he's going to come back and take them on.
This is another major example of Milwaukee Democrats involved in some really nasty primaries.
An interesting footnote to what you mentioned about Mandela not filing in time or filing notice of non-candidacy. That law was created because of Leon Young, who is in danger of being kicked off the ballot because of problems with the nomination papers. If he loses this case, it would be kind of the ultimate irony.
It certainly would.
If you will, because if you go back, this is many years ago, but his aunt, I believe, held the assembly seat.
Yes.
And didn't tell anybody until last minute she was going to run. He came in last second.
A few minutes before the 5 p.m.
papers,
filing deadline.
Only candidate got the seat, has held it now for 20 some years.
That would be the ultimate irony.
Yes.
Common Cause noted that we have 115 seats in the ledge up in November. Mm-hmm. 46 of them either are unopposed or only a third-party candidate, which Jay Heck says just proves the result of gerrymandering in the district lines. That's just an aside. Any thoughts on that or move on?
It's just part of the nature of maps. I mean, go back. This is not anything new. You can't create a competitive district in Washington County. You can't create a competitive seat on the Isthmus of Madison. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So a lot of these seats just don't get challenged. Now, Joe Winicky, former Democratic Party chairman, used to always argue a rising tide lifts all boats. And one of Joe's old goals was 99 candidates in the assembly just in case. And it worked in 06 with the wave that they caught. They knocked off, but they weren't expecting to beat with these guys who, hey, they put him on the ballot. If you're not there, you can't win. Now, I don't think some of these guys are unchallenged, really in danger of losing, but that's one philosophy of, hey, take a chance. You never know what's going to happen.
And just a further note, as of today, we finally have all six members of both the elections and the Ethics mm-hmm. Commission. The governor put Beverly Gill of Burlington and Julie Glancy of Sheboygan on the Elections Commission, and just today he put former judge and former state senator Mac Davis and reserve judge Kinney on the Ethics Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So both those panels are setting up shop on July 1.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. New topic. Let's trade notes on the Democratic Convention. Mm-hmm. I'll go first. 1,104 delegates, alternates, and guests. Standing room only on Saturday, although the room was smaller.
Yeah.
I was kind of impressed by the energy. I didn't think they really went at it, Bernie versus Clinton. But I was impressed by the energy. Your impression?
Well, it's an interesting
excuse me.
Comparison, Republican convention, Democratic convention. There was maybe they had an easier time with a happy face on the unity message for Democrats at the convention. But part of that might have been because you remember the Republican convention in May, Donald Trump had just basically sealed the deal that Tuesday. So if you remember the effort the anti-Trump movement put into Wisconsin, for some of those people, it's like, ugh, it just happened. It was just too fresh. Now, this past weekend, the race wasn't over. They hadn't voted in California
right.
and these other places. So for the Bernie people,
New Jersey, Montana,
when we'd ask them, well, are you ready to bet? Hey, the race isn't over. He can still win. Sweep these states on Tuesday. So if they were to have the convention this weekend, maybe be a different thing. But at least for this past weekend, it was easier to be unified because there wasn't that reality of it's over. Now, the party also took some strides whereas Donald Trump had no presence at the Republican convention. The party sent a letter to delegates signed by both the Clinton and Sanders campaigns outlining how they'd work together on committee assignments. And if you look this week, the party put out its list of appointees, these national convention committees. There was one more Bernie backer than Clinton backer appointed. They really stressed the transparency. There also wasn't like Nevada, we had the chair throwing incident, whatever it was.
It wasn't there.
That wasn't there because there also wasn't really a delegate selection process convention.
Right.
It was done already.
And that vote on superdelegates, in other words, excuse me, there's a recommendation mm-hmm. from the Wisconsin Democrats that the DNC abolish superdelegates 4 years from now.
Yep.
That passed, but there wasn't a lot of rancor. There wasn't a lot of debate.
There also was a resolution encouraging the superdelegates, or 10 superdelegates, to go 6-4 for Sanders
yeah.
to reflect that he won the state with 56.6% of the vote in April as a proportional. Now, it has non-binding and has no weight. And oh, by the way, the day after Hillary Clinton basically clinched, Jason Ray, one of the last three uncommitted superdelegates backed her.
Yeah.
It's now 7-1 in Clinton's favor. That's not going to change. So, for the Clinton folks, they're like, we couldn't care less about these resolutions. They want to do it, great. Oh, by the way, we're winning on pledged delegates anyway.
Yeah.
So we don't need, you know, it's not like this is a lifesaver for us. We're okay with these resolutions.
One other thing that I want to land on. I was curious who was elected, the four Wisconsin representatives to the DNC. Martha Love of Milwaukee, African-American, reelected. Jason Ray, reelected. But the two new ones, State Senator Janet Bewley from Mason, yes, Northwest Wisconsin, and Eau Claire City Councilman Andrew Werthmann. So here's my question. You had last year the election of Martha Lanning from the Fox Valley as chair, mm-hmm, and now you have to the DNC to Western Wisconsin. Do you see any breakup in the traditional Democratic power axis of Madison and Milwaukee?
Well, Ray and Love are part of the establishment.
Yes, they are.
Janet Bewley is a sitting state lawmaker, and Andrew Werthmann is a city council. So it's, and I think Andrew is the only one I know that's a really big, or was a big Sanders backer. I know he's an appointee to a national committee. Even though he doesn't take office till after the convention, he got appointed to a committee at the convention as a Sanders, you know, kind of backer.
Yep.
It wasn't like a progressive revolt, if you will. Like it was, like Lanning was seen as the outsider, the progressive candidate. Where Ray,
she beat Jason Ray, beat main, Joseph Winicky.
Her main opponent was kind of seen as part of a continuation of the Mike Tate years, if you will. So yep, you didn't really see an uprising necessarily, and part of it is because, you know, the people you're talking about, they went out and campaigned. They got delegate lists. They sent letters. They made phone calls. They lined up support. Brian Kennedy, former AFT president,
Mayor
also
Glendale.
Mayor Glendale.
Yes.
He kind of put out a little bit more. He was a Bernie backer.
Yep.
He didn't win.
He didn't make it.
You know, so it's hard to say that. And with these kind of extension of the primaries we're seeing with Democrats, there isn't a constant theme of it's always Sanders versus Clinton people, or always outsider versus establishment. It's not really a clear break, but there is definitely something happening with Democrats where all these primaries are going on, that there's some unease in the base for some reason.
And I want to mention one more thing. In her speech, Chairman Lanning laid out a kind of a little engine that can strategy to regain control of the legislature. She said, we're going to do it by the 2020 election so they can be a part of redrawing the new mm-hmm boundaries, which is three election cycles, 16, 18, and 20. So she's saying we're going to take a little bit more, a few more wins in 16, 18, and 20. And the ultimate irony is the Democrats were in control 10 years ago in 2010, and they lost it a decade in the wilderness. So your impression of her half-notch turn, 16 elections, half-notch, and we'll get there in 20.
It is not realistic to think that Democrats would win back control of the Senate this fall, barring a Donald Trump, like, complete washout, like it's a nightmare for Republicans, bloodbath, like the worst thing we've seen in the history of, you know, Wisconsin politics. Then maybe Democrats win the Senate. The Assembly, the map is too good for Republicans. There are too many seats to make up. It's just not really realistic. Democrats know they can do it, a multi-cycle process.
Yeah.
Their issue, though, is that the better seats to run in are in the off year in the Senate in 2018. If Hillary Clinton wins this fall, there will probably be, again, probably, we're talking a long time in politics, a snapback against the White House. There always is.
Mm-hmm.
18, they're the better seats for Democrats, but the worse environment. So they really need to pick up at least one this fall, make some progress, and get somewhere within striking range and hope for a good 2020.
Okay.
Now, if Trump wins, and there is definitely a path for Trump to win, you see a snapback against Trump likely, because that's the dynamic in politics anymore, that 18 with the good seats could be a better environment to win. Their better bet, really, win the governor's office. If they can win the governor's office in 18, it takes care of all these problems.
Okay.
The Assembly's not in play. It's either gov's office or Senate to give them a seat at the table. If
to
they
make
don't
them
have
players.
It, if they don't have it, it could be a decade in the wilderness, another decade.
Another decade in the wilderness. Okay, I want to spend a little bit of time on this dust-up yesterday. Yesterday is wrong. When Milwaukee cops chased alleged carjackers into a Milwaukee suburb, first-term Republican legislator Janelle Brangen said, I'd had enough. She said, I will no longer sit by telling the mayor, while you destroy Milwaukee and its flourishing suburbs. She said, let's cut future state aid if Milwaukee doesn't control its crime problem, which is very interesting, and it's a dust-up. Mayor Barrett's spokesman said the mayor is addressing public safety on all fronts, and he would welcome Legislator Branchell's assistance, and the governor just said, can we all step back here? I don't think combating crime by taking away money is the answer. What's your thought on this dust-up?
There's definitely a little bit of unhappiness, unease, whatever you want to say, with Republicans, with the WOW counties over how Milwaukee's being run, because they see investments in streetcar, mm-hmm, which they don't like.
Mm-hmm.
They want to address the crime problem. You know, they want this thing taken care of. And people a lot of times move out of the city, out of Milwaukee County, get away from the crime problem. So if you put it in your backyard, that brings it home. That said, I don't see a big thirst right now, to cut share revenue,
no.
other revenue,
no.
to Milwaukee as punishment, because then it exacerbates the situation. Now, Branchon said, hey, if you have money for a streetcar, you can find money for some. You can find it somewhere else. So that's her answer to that. The governor's not really on board. And it, you know from covering the budget, you can't single out a city. You have to, though, create only a first-class city mm-hmm. of this would have to have this happen to share revenue payment. It gets a little tricky to do that.
And Milwaukee's the only first-class city. And, of course, David Clark said that Representative Branchon was brave. And Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley said, no, we all have to work together, wrong approach. But I asked the Fiscal Bureau to look it up, JR. There is a county and municipal aid fund, let me get the number right, of $630.4 million. And I was astonished. This year, Milwaukee will get $217.5 million of that, or 34%. So that just puts some context on this mm-hmm. dust up. Okay, let's talk about Wispolitik's stock report.
So rising Mike Gallagher, Republican for the 8th Congressional District,
yep.
first up on TV in the district. Interesting that guy who was born in Green Bay but moved to California after his parents split up and came back for the summers, running his first ads, and he's home to run for Congress. That addresses one of the big kind of issues in that race, if you will, about where this guy is from, his ties to the district. His family has been there for a long time, but he has not. After going to college out east, he served on the Capitol Hill, moved back less than a year ago to work for Governor Walker's campaign. So he's not really somebody who's been around for a long time. Personally, his family has. Now, the issue is Frank Lissay.
Right.
We've known for years.
Frank,
who
calls
years,
Gallagher D.C. Mike.
Yes. That Frank Lissay has an official residence in the district, but has a house in Racine. They have a blended family. They go back and forth. There have been questions for a long time about where Frank lives. It may be harder for Frank Lissay to make an issue of Gallagher not truly being from the district, if you will. Add running. He's got a super PAC, by the way,
yep.
with John Gard's fingerprints all over it,
yep.
Helping him out. John Bolton, the former ambassador, is giving him $5,000. So the establishment, if you will, is rallying around Gallagher. And the question kind of becomes, how much you got to spend to build this guy's name ID in a district where he's not really from? Well, he's got money to do
it. I'm intrigued by that first Gallagher ad, because part of it is firing a weapon. Mm-hmm. Once a Marine, always a Marine.
Shows him firing a handgun.
Semper Fi, you can booyah.
I'm here to take on the big challenges. And a guy in a Green Bay windbreaker walking an elderly woman down the street. I mean, it strikes all the tones as a hometown kid come home to make good.
Interesting. But, yep, okay, mixed.
Kathleen Vinehout.
Why?
Talked to her at convention.
Yeah.
She wants to run for governor again. And you know what? The professional operative class in the Democratic Party does not want her to. Here's somebody who, go back to the recall election in 2012, I think she got 4% in a four-way primary.
I think you're right.
Five-way primary, because there was that fake Democrat. Remember,
we only need four digits, 4% in the recall primary.
But she was gearing up to run in 2014. She was all but in. 2013 December, gets in that car wreck, bangs up her arm, drops out of the race. If that had not happened, I am pretty sure she would have challenged Mary Burke for the nomination. She sounds interested to do it again. Now, here's the thing. She's not well-known in Madison, Milwaukee. She has a progressive kind of rural populism attraction in western Wisconsin.
She's her mama.
But if you go back on her record, their constituency in the Democratic Party don't like her positions on abortion, on guns, on these other issues, and don't really think she's a true, like, progressive, if you will, by their definition.
Right.
The other thing, though, is Democrats don't have a clear gubernatorial candidate to shake on. If Governor Walker runs for a third term, they don't have a clear... Ron Kind, his name's mentioned. He's got problems with the base on trade.
I had a staffer come up and suggest Dana Walks.
I'll get to him. Jennifer Schilling, his name is mentioned.
Yes.
She's also got two young kids. She's 46. I think she's got plenty of time running in the future. Peter Barker's name is mentioned, probably because he is minority leader.
What's your read on Walks?
Walks, I think Walks is interested. When I talked to him, he said, I'm only focused on 2016 right now. He's got a Republican opponent. Very Democratic seat.
Yeah.
The question for him is, can he put enough money in of his own to build his name ID? Because, look, Tommy Thompson went from the Assembly to the governor's office 30 years ago. But that was 30 years. He was also a minority leader. Much more high-profile job. Much different environment in terms of, like, media coverage and getting your name out there and TV ads and everything else. So you run down the gamut. I mean, I think Democrats would love to see a private sector person run again. But who is that person?
Okay.
There are all these folks who've got issues. Joe Parisi announced for re-election this week for Daniel Exec. we think he wants to run again.
Oh, you
but
know
another,
he does.
Another Madison liberal running, that's not what they really, the professional, I say they,
yeah.
professional operative class are going, that's not the perfect camp profile for a race. So who is that person? That's a good question right
okay.
now.
Okay, and then following, you've got Ron Kind, and I wonder why you got him, because he has no Republican opponent in November as a primary.
Senator Johnson's report last week had what may be the most damaging tie between the veteran who died at Tomah and a lawmaker, and that is a 7-minute and 39-second phone call to Kind's office before he died. Now, we don't know what happened during that phone call. Kind's office has no record of it. There's no log. If you are a sitting congressperson, you do a very good job of logging these calls, setting things up the chain, and flagging issues like this. Why was that not done? Why is that call there? If there's more to it, it could be a real vulnerability for him. Now, the primary challenge he has, Myron Buchholz.
History teacher out of Eau Claire.
He is a Bernie Sanders Democrat. He got a good reception at convention over the weekend, but you know, Ron Kind's got $2 million in the bank. He's well known. I don't think he's going to have a real problem with the primary. Republicans would drop the ball, possibly, and not having somebody run against him.
And Myron Buchholz, in his speech at the convention, did not mention the Tomah VA scandal.
No, he mentioned trade, because Ron Kind has an issue with trade with the base.
Right.
Now, all this said, I don't think he's in any danger of losing, but that call, that's the most direct tie that we've seen so far of somebody. It wasn't a report a staffer didn't pass on. It was a call like that, and it was not after the fact. It was before he passed away. That's a little of an issue to deal with. I don't know if it's going to be a big enough one, and Republicans will tell you it wouldn't have made enough difference in that district anyway. That's why they didn't have him run, but not the best thing for Ron Kind to have that on his record.
Okay, but just a P.S. When I had my one-on-one with Ron Kind, mm-hmm. I asked him, when did you hear about problems at the VA? You or your staff, and what did you do? That's in the Wisconsin Eye Archives. We're out of time. Just this programming note, I've got grandkids to spoil next Friday, so there won't be any Rewind. Rewind will be back on June 24th. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.